Hi there.
Hi, thank you.
No trouble. I'm going to I just had a couple of my devices were signed out, so I just need a moment to get them signed in. I'll get everything sorted in just a moment.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Tamira, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Good enough. I like being here. That's good.
Me too. I don't know that I'm going to make it the whole night, though. I'm tired.
Yeah. You work today?
I went skiing.
Oh, that's fabulous. Right, you're down near the mountains, aren't you?
I am. I think that's a good set of pronouns for me. What do you think?
What?
They, them, 12th man.
Not perfect.
You know what I'm talking about.
Sure. What, the Seahawks won, right?
They sure did.
So you were the 12th man.
I'm one of many. One of
One of
many.
many, yeah, thousands and thousands of just
Yeah, I
wonderful.
came up last time they won the Super Bowl and there were 700,000 people at the victory parade. I don't know where they all came from, but it was wild. Yeah. Oh. Do you follow football?
No, my son does. Yeah. What do I follow? Well,
The Dharma.
Tuary and Tim and
I
Carrie.
follow them too.
All
On
you guys.
Saturday, I followed Matthew Brensilver. That was pretty enjoyable. He's lovely.
Who's that one?
Oh, he's great. He did a day long on Metta.
Oh, nice.
He is something else, that guy.
Brent
So,
Silver, you say?
Brensilver, Matthew Brensilver.
Brent Silver, where did you find him?
I actually took the Buddhist psychology training through Spirit Rock, and he teaches that.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, you're up to so much, Tamira. Wow.
I'm causing all sorts of trouble.
I'm just trying to keep my head above water, but oh, we're doing fine. I'm learning to watercolor. That's my.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it takes me to a place that's, well, it can take me to very nice places.
Yeah.
It's also very frustrating, but, you know.
Yeah, I've never been able to maintain any sort of art practice other than the daily writing I do for work. It's just
Yeah.
don't have the patience, determination to stick with something to learn it like that.
Well, I'm retired, so I'm retired, but I
That's
mean,
good.
I went to the gym today and I walked for 20 minutes.
That's nice.
Yeah, that's what I can
Oh,
do.
it's a nice day up there too. Sunny in Seattle,
I
wasn't it?
know, I could have
Oh,
gone.
it's terrible here. This horrible cloud just sits over us when it's
Oh.
sunny. Are you going to go out and see the Northern Lights tonight?
Well, I'll check, yeah.
It sounds like people have been seeing them all the halfway down the country already.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm in the city, in Seattle, so
Yeah.
it's hard to get a dark spot.
Yeah.
I will, definitely. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, I think for me to see him, I would have to go 40 miles to the west. Well, maybe 30 miles to the west, but then I'm down in the gorge and there's big walls
Oh, yeah.
of gorge blocking the view. So I'm not really
Oh.
sure where I could go other than Portland, but then it's bright. So.
My husband just brought me a cup of half a cup of instant coffee. Thank you,
Well, that
Hank.
was so nice of him.
It was very nice. I phoned him up about 10 minutes ago, just feeling like I need a little artificial pep to.
I'm not even gonna bother. I'm just gonna maybe sit and go to bed. I'm not needed after greeting.
Well, that is your job. I mean, that is your position.
That is. I made it up myself.
I remember that. That's right.
Remember, we didn't used to have a greeter, but they had one
That's
on
right.
Thursday night, and I was like, hey, can we have one on Monday?
Oh, here's Cheryl. Things will get fixed.
Oh yeah.
I think we're a little
She's good at fixing things.
oh man.
I mean, if worse comes to worse, I can log in the back way and then I'll have host power or co-host power.
You will?
If I log in through the Sim Zoom
Oh,
rather
you
than
have
as
an
myself.
you can
And
get in.
I have the passwords, yeah.
Okay.
Because there I lead a couple. I lead the queer sit, and that's the Sims 2 account, and then occasionally I'll fill in for Tim. I'm filling in for Tim tomorrow morning, so I have the
Okay.
main Sims password. I'm still debating coming up to Seattle for the day that Judith and I are teaching.
Now, remind me when that is.
March 2nd.
Oh, nice. That's a little ways off. I can get
Yeah.
a look at that. Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to do that. I'd like to do more of these day-longs. I've done one at the end of Tim's class.
Oh, fun. We're not doing a day long. We're just teaching on the evening, Monday night.
Great. You
Yeah.
are.
But I guess she and I should do a day long. That'd be fun.
Well,
I'll propose that to her.
your name's in lights. It's awesome.
Yeah, it would be fun. I was thinking it would be fun to come and do it in person because I've never been there.
Oh,
But
yeah.
it sure is a long drive. It's probably 6 hours, so.
Really?
I mean, I'm a long ways. I'm an hour east of Portland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Boy, I almost look into a regional airline.
Yeah, I'm not much of a plane person. I'd rather just drive my ass up there on Monday morning.
See, we're getting any help here? Okay.
There he is. Now he's going to make us co-hosts.
Okay. Remind me your name again. I'm sorry. Is this Ryan? Yes. Oh no, I cannot hear you. No.
There we go. Are you hearing us now?
Yes, thank you.
Excellent. Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. So, can you make us co-hosts? Hi, is this Ryan? Can you make us co-hosts? I should have said please.
Yeah, you gotta say please, Kathy. Oh, look at all those people.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get to work. See you later, Tamir.
Oh, you're leaving? Okay, bye.
Well, I'm just going to do a bunch of stuff now.
Okay. You gonna
Okay.
let some people in?
No, I got to get some things. I got to do a whole bunch of host stuff first.
Oh, well, I'll let some people in if you want.
Yeah. Hey, Ryan. I don't see that I'm a co-host yet.
You are a co-host.
Where do you see it?
I see it in the list of participants. You are a
Okay,
co-host.
fine. Okay,
Yeah.
fine. I'll get to work. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, you get to work. I'll let some people in.
All right. Okay, there we go.
Hi,
Okay.
Carla.
Tamira.
How's it going?
Hi. A while.
I know I don't know where I was the first week. I was at a city council meeting last week. Have a little chat with them about Sanctuary City. So, yeah.
Oh,
Hello,
excellent.
Kanika.
Good for you.
Yeah. Hi, Maggie, Leonard. Welcome to all of you. Hello, hello. I don't know if Manish is connected or not, but hello if you are connected. Sometimes I can't tell. No, connecting to audio still. I'll let that in. Char and Chip will let them in. Maybe this is why they don't let me do the admitting usually, because I talk to myself. Hello, Ed.
I'm here.
Nice to see you. How are you? Oh, Manish is connected
Good.
now too. Hi. Hello, Shar. Hello, Chip. Welcome. And hi, Kay.
Hi.
How's it going, Shar? Hi, Kay. Hi, Manish. I don't know if I'm saying your name right. Are you new to us? I haven't met you before.
Yeah, I'm new. My son has been regularly coming. I am from India. He's in Seattle. He told me to join.
You're halfway across the world?
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, welcome. Warm welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hello, Deggy. Hello, Carlos.
Hi everyone.
How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. How about you? Everyone is good?
I'm good.
Good, good.
I'm tired. I might leave early tonight.
Are you following the monks?
I occasionally
Monks are
see them on
peaceful.
pace. Yeah, I mean, that's beautiful. I have to admit I'm following the Seahawks more closely. The
All
monks
right.
will take over after the season is done.
Okay. I'm just curious, that's all.
Yeah, I think many of us are at least aware of the monks for sure.
Okay,
Yeah, it's
sounds
really
good.
beautiful and
It is.
timely. Yeah,
Yes, it
yeah,
is. Well,
yeah.
thank you.
Hello, Joanna, Carlos, Tracy. Good to see all of you. Hi, May. How's it going?
Hi, everyone.
Glad you're here tonight. There's Judith. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Tamira.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to teaching with you. I think we're going to have fun.
I know we're going to have fun.
We're totally going to have fun.
Totally going to have fun. Yeah. And
Nobody
so
else
got
might have
joy.
fun.
So, you know, yeah.
I know. I mean, what's
And
not to like about that?
what's not to like? Yeah.
Hello, Douglas. Welcome. Oh, and Alima's here too. Hi. Judith, are you going to go see the Northern Lights? Is it clear up there?
It's clear and cold. I'd have to go a long way to see them.
Oh, really? Is it bright or?
Testing.
City lights, you know,
Ah.
and trees all over
Those trees.
the
Pesky. Pesky. Hello, Joyce. And Lauren. Hi, Carol. Who else? Hi, Carol. Excuse me. Hi, Catherine and Roxanne. Welcome, everyone. I'm just randomly messing with Kathy and letting people in.
I did that one. I mean, I
Something.
confess, I did that song.
Hello. There we go. And I can
Oh, hi,
adjust your
Arv.
levels.
Hi, Arv.
Okay. And then.
And let's see. Hello to Beth and Will and Tara Lee and Julie. And who else did I miss?
Please.
Oh, and Raul and Janelle.
Thank you. Okay.
Hi, Eva and Liz and Daniel and Gary. Welcome. What's up? Hey, Bob and Debbie,
Oh.
welcome. Hi, Debbie.
Leave it. Thank you.
Hi, Carolyn. And welcome to Michelle and Jim and Joy. Nice to see everybody.
Hi, Tamara.
What's up, Carolyn?
Hi. Hanging in there.
Good. Let's see. Everybody, raise your human hand if you're going to try and see the Northern Lights tonight. It's supposed to be super bright. So, no, just a few people.
What time?
Oh, like now on through the night. Yeah.
Okay.
Ooh.
We should try that.
We've tried.
Yeah, people are already seeing them
Or if
down
the
in
northern lights are going to be visible here.
Yeah.
So we'll check it
Yeah.
out when I'm done. I'll check it out at 9.
Hello, Kim, and the second person named Beth and Sherry and Valerie. Nice to see you, Valerie. Let's see. Did I say hi to Jim? Maybe. Hi, Jim. All right, we'll hand it over to Arv.
Hello, everyone.
Enjoy the evening.
Can you all hear me online? Does that work too? I get thumbs ups. Wow, lots of thumbs ups. And I know you all can hear me because I know how this works in real life, this whole speaking and ears thing. Yeah. Well, welcome. My name is Arvind. I'll be teaching today or doing something. I feel like I'll be leading a discussion and co-leading an exploration more than teaching. Yeah. Let's begin with our regular sit, shall we sit? Yeah. I'm going to ring a bell once at the beginning and then three times at the end in about 40 minutes, and I'll offer a little guidance.
And I forgot to tell you also when you ask if there's anyone new.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, is there anyone new? You're new. Welcome. Welcome. Wonderful to see new folks here. Online, do I see anyone new? Is there anyone there? I can't see everyone at once, but welcome if you're there. All right. So, for people who are new, I'll just mention a little about the format before we begin. There will be a 40-minute sit. I'll offer some guidance during the sit. I think I offer a little more guidance than most people do, but I'll keep it relatively spare. And then I'll give a talk, and that'll be about 40 minutes too. And then there'll be time afterward for questions, discussion. I'm really interested in discussion for this particular topic, so I hope people are chatty. And then some announcements as well. Yeah. And in between this meditation and the talking, there will be about 5 minutes of bio break. All right, let's begin. We begin where we are. So, where are you? What's your body doing? What's going on in your external environment? Maybe you can sense what you're touching. Sense the sounds in the room or the space. And as we arrive, this sense deepens. Perhaps we begin with the most obvious things that our body is touching. And as it deepens, we get a subtler sense. Maybe we notice the feeling of air or clothing, the sounds that we filter out. Arriving, bringing our minds, bringing our attention to where our body is in this moment, arriving. As we arrive, it can be helpful to cultivate an intention to be available, to open to what's here. It can be helpful to approach this with kindness. Kindness to what you find, kindness to your own responses to what you find. Curiosity. What is this? What things about this experience do we take for granted? What things do we ignore or turn away from? This becoming available can feel like softening, can feel like I'm becoming a little more porous. Allowing. And as we meet our experience, also helpful is dropping all of the fixing. The assessing, evaluating, the criticizing. We're just here to abide with experience, not to fix it, not to fix ourselves. Noting that arriving is a process. It's not something we check off and are done with. We keep arriving. We drift, we arrive. Similarly, we keep putting energy into this availability. We keep remembering how we want to show up, whether that's with kindness or curiosity or other values that you align with. Re-arriving if needed. This is something we can do in any moment, just bringing ourselves back. In that moment when I drift, it's a great time to also drop the fixing, drop the judgment. Just come back. No recriminations. if there is torpor, fatigue, can be good to remember what you're here for. Why did you show up today? What is the serve in your life? Connect with that intention. And use it to bring some energy to practice. From this place of availability and arriving, we can choose an object of meditation. You might choose the breath or the feeling of the body sitting. If you're with the breath, you might note how the arising and falling of the breath, the inhale and exhale cycle, mirrors the arising and passing of all the phenomena we're available to. Where you are now is not where you were when you began this meditation. Phenomena come and they go. The breath rises, the breath falls. With each inhale, we can take in what's new in this moment. With each exhale, we can let things be, we can let them pass in their time. drawing support. Support for this continued awareness. This continued inquiry, drawing it from the ground beneath us, the earth we rest on, the Sangha, all of us sitting together, doing the same thing. The Dhamma, what you know to be true. Arriving again and again. Over and over into this body, into this moment. Once again becoming available, opening, encouraging kindness, curiosity. Just as phenomena arise and pass, so too do these intentions come cyclically. We repeat them over and over. They're not fixed. They are processes. in the last few minutes of the sit, you may wish to stoke this kindness you're bringing to experience, to let it grow, and to wash through you so that you are a recipient of loving kindness, and through you to the Sangha, to those you hold close, and from there to this world. May we be well. May we know ease. May we free ourselves from suffering. We have about 5 minutes now for bio breaks and stretching and wiggles. I think Tim also makes his Dana announcement now. So there's the opportunity to give Dana to Sims or to the teachers. I think it's at the front at the table. So if that's part of your practice, that's something available. All right. Y'all can hear me still? The microphone thing worked? Oh, ring the bell. That's a nice trick. Just once?
15 times.
Oh, 15, huh?
It's just so people hang out.
Yeah, it's a good idea. It's a good idea. Give people a moment to arrive back in the room. So welcome everybody. I'm Arvind. I normally don't teach here on Mondays. I teach on the Sunday team. So those of you who come on Sundays may have seen me there. And we have a new, whole new year, don't we? We're talking about transcendental dependent arising. So I have to say, when I heard that we were doing transcendental dependent arising sometime at the end of last year, I did not say, oh, that old thing. I was like, what? What are we doing? So I'm here to say I'm a student of this teaching. I'm learning alongside all of you. And this month, right, is an overview of what we'll be going over this year. So I'll be giving my take on the overview from the seat of a student, right, who's looking at this. I want to say also that, you know, I've heard from several people who've looked at this that it feels familiar, even though this is something we haven't touched, maybe, or this is a particular sutta, this is the Upanishad sutta that we're kind of that describes transcendental dependent arising. Even if we haven't looked at that, we're drawing from Dhamma that we've done before. Right? So for those of us who've been doing this, you'll hear a lot that's familiar. And for those of us who are new, it'll be wonderful and fresh. So as I mentioned a moment ago, this teaching, this is not one that you see everywhere, transcendental dependent arising. There's another dependent arising, which I'm going to refer to, and I think Bhikkhu Bodhi refers to, as the mundane dependent arising, and I'll tell you why we use that word in a moment. That dependent arising is something that is taught, I think, pretty frequently, pretty regularly. This transcendental bit, this is different. There aren't a lot of teachings on this, and, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi has a really great, he reads the Upanishad Sutta, and he goes through it and he describes it, and he has the perspective, and I feel like I agree as I read it that this is kind of a hidden gem. You know, he says, I'm surprised that this isn't more talked about. This sutta, this little sutta, it has so much in it. There's something really big in this message, and we don't talk about it very often. And so what I want to do, I'm going to share my screen. Let's see if this works. Because I want to have this, for me, it's very helpful to have on my screen or in front of me kind of the look of what this is like. Let's see here. Screen sharing, slideshow. All right. Can you all see? You all can see it up there? Okay. I'll move over. I see that this is blocking a little bit. There we go. You all can see it now? Great. And those of you online, can I get a thumbs up from someone? Can you see it also? Well, on that screen, let's see here. Okay. All right. So your screen sharing is paused, it says. They can see it? Okay, great. All right. So I wanted to list both of the sequences here because I find it really helpful to have it in front of me. So the Upanishad Sutta goes through, it talks about dependent arising in general. And what we're talking about when we talk about dependent arising is really just causality. We're talking about one thing leading to the next thing, leading to the next thing, leading to the next thing. Everything that arises in our experience, you all were just meditating. Everything that arose in your experience, everything you noticed, every time you were distracted, every time there was a thought, every time there was a sound, every experience we have is the set is conditioned by something else. Something comes before it. There is a cause, there is a consequence. We hear a sound, it causes, it's a stimulus. We have a response to that stimulus. We think a thing, we react in a way, you know. All of this cause and effect, that's what's meant by dependent arising. Everything is dependent. Everything that arises is dependent on a set of causes. So the mundane sequence of dependent arising, the one that's done more often, that's the list on the left here. This goes through the fact that it, you know, our suffering, right, has a cause, right? Birth is the cause of suffering. You know, number 12 is caused by number 11. I know it's kind of funny, right? Birth is the cause of suffering. Sounds really dire, you know? And birth is caused by existence, existence by clinging, clinging by craving, craving by feeling, and so on and so forth. And the root cause of all of this is our ignorance, right? That's the traditional sequence. And in the traditional sequence, what it's pointing to is that this is the thing we do over and over. This is what we repeat. This is the mundane because this is what we do normally, right? We go through this constant sequence. We're always, you know, we're creating more suffering. And from suffering, we go back to ignorance, and ignorance to kama, to consciousness. We're continuing the cycle over and over again. That cycle is talked about in many different places. What makes the Upanishad Sutta special is that it also describes this other transcendental sequence. It says, but hey, when we get to suffering, sometimes, if we create the right conditions, we don't just keep going in this circle that leads to more suffering and more suffering. We shoot off. We can shoot off on this transcendental sequence, following that dashed line, right, that you see on the graph. We can shoot off, and we can start to overcome this suffering. We can start down a path that leads to the end of the suffering, right? And so in the sutta, right, it actually goes in reverse order. It starts with the, you know, the knowledge of the ending of the fetters on, you know, on the bottom right there. Goes from there to freedom, to dispassion. It goes in reverse order, all the way to suffering, all the way back to ignorance. Okay? It's done that way. And then it goes twice in the forward order. Okay? It repeats it two more times in the forward order. And it describes the movement. There's a quote. I want to read the quote because I think it's really beautiful. It describes the movement going from one element to the next as being like when rain descends heavily upon some mountaintop. The water flows down along with the slope and fills the clefts, gullies, and creeks. These being filled, fill up the pools. These being filled, fill up the ponds. These being filled, fill up the streams. These being filled, fill up the rivers. The rivers being filled, fill up the great ocean. So it comes tumbling down in this beautiful process. So I like to apply that particularly to the transcendental side, since that's the pleasant side, right? This is the good stuff. And you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi, when he talks about the Upanishad Sutta, he finds it particularly significant that we start in the reverse order. And he has a really dense, he has a really dense to me explanation of it. I actually wrote down the quote here because I wanted to read it because it's like comically dense to me. But Well, here, I'm going to read a little bit of it because some of you may get this like more quickly than I did. He says, what we have here is not an instance of a simple one-directional causality proceeding forward, unmodified in a straight line. Okay? We have, rather, a species of teleological causality involving purpose, intelligence, and planned striving simultaneously projected toward and refracted from the aimed at effect in a process of reciprocal determination. In the workings of this relationship, not only does the path facilitate the achievement of the goal, but the goal as well, already present from the outset, itself bends back to participate in the shaping of the path. Starting from man's awareness of the painful inadequacies of his existence and his intuitive groping toward a condition where these are allayed, the formula proceeds to trace back in terms derivative from and constantly checked against the goal being the end of suffering, the series of alterations he must induce in his cognitive and emotive makeup to bring the goal into his reach. So I was like, woo, thanks, Bhikkhu, you know, when I first read this. But I read it over and over, and I have this interpretation of what he's trying to say. Because I mentioned this because there was a question that really was interesting to me in the last Monday, where someone asked, is this a sequence? And to where I gave an answer that yes, this is in fact a sequence, right? And we get that from this. But there's this complexity to this. So sequence meaning suffering leads to faith, leads to joy, leads to rapture, leads to tranquility, so on and so forth. But there's this complexity, which is that things don't automatically and impersonally go from suffering to faith to joy. We can't just sit here suffering and expect it to come on, right? Even if we've got some of the conditions, the faith, the joy, we can't naturally expect things to move to the rapture, to the tranquility. It doesn't just happen like that, you know, in the same way that some, you know, some processes in nature, one thing naturally leads to the next automatically, right? Instead, we need a sense of the goal we're trying to reach, right? We don't break free of the left side, the mundane side, and jump to the transcendental side unless we have a sense and some kind of, you know, dedication to the fact that we're trying to get to the bottom of the bottom right-hand side here. We're trying to get to the freedom. We're trying to get to the end of suffering, right? So a sense of that goal is necessary, and also some intention and effort, particularly the intention and effort to create the conditions for the next step in the path, the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. And so, while I was thinking about this, I was also reflecting, okay, well, we have the Eightfold Path. That's what we spent all of last year doing, right? We are eight of the months. We were going through the Eightfold Path. And so I think it's helpful to think the Eightfold Path tells you what to do. It's a description of what to do. It's about creating the conditions. This is a description of what happens to you. This is what happens if those conditions are created. This is the path we go down. Now, one thing I want to mention also, the Buddha's path, right, kind of reflects this. So the Buddha left home, right, left his wealthy life to pursue this path. And it's described that he left with a confidence that there must be some end to this suffering. Like, there's gotta be something. There's gotta be something better than this. And that confidence is a sense of the goal he's trying to reach, right? That is the sense that we're going to the bottom right-hand side of this diagram, right? And, you know, what he didn't know quite, right, at that time was the specific path. How are we gonna get there, right? So that's the fourth noble truth, right? The path itself. But he left with this sense that there was a third noble truth. There was an end to suffering. There was something to go with. So mirrored in that path is what we're actually being asked to do here, right? In order to go through the sequence, we are asked to look to the end of it, right? And we are asked to create well, he's given us the fourth thing, right? He didn't know it when he started, but now he's created the path. Right. So we're a little easier off than he was. We have the Noble Eightfold Path. We have the conditions we need to create. Okay. I wanted to spend some time going over, let's see, how long have I done? Oh, goodness. Okay, I've taken 15 minutes. I wanted to go through the path that's described here and just talk about some of the things, maybe from a more personal sense, you know, after reading this, of what I see in this, where I see it reflected in my own practice, and maybe you can see it reflected. My hope is that this helps you see it in your own practice as well, to see how we get from one thing to another. So we start with suffering, but of course, we're taking that suffering, right, on the transcendental path from the end of the mundane, right? So there's a sense in which the first transcendence, right, the first real move into transcendence is the movement from suffering to faith, right? That's kind of the first thing we see happening here. And just as I mentioned before, that dashed arrow going from the left list to the right list, it's not to be taken for granted, right? You know, that's a wheel that we could just keep going into. So, you know, the faith is this belief, this idea that we can take another path, right? This idea there's got to be a better way, right? This is the faith they're talking about. We go through suffering over and over. We see ourselves hit the same roadblocks in life, the same habits, the same things we always do. We keep coming back to suffering, and at some point we're like, there's got to be something better, right? There's got to be some way. And that is the faith, right? Like, recall for yourselves, what brought you to this room or this Zoom call, right? Why are you sitting here? What brought you here? How did you get here? And, you know, if I think of it that way, the word faith often, like, when I first hear it, it's kind of an icky word for me. But when I think of it in these terms, right? Yeah, something called me out of it, right? Something called all of us here out of this, you know, this pattern. There's something that we wanted that was more than that, right? That's why we're here. That's the faith. Faith to joy. So faith in the Dhamma, faith in this path, faith that something's got to be out there, right? Starts to create a confidence. You know, we start to see that suffering is something that we cause to ourselves, right? And when we see that there really is a path, when we start to see, oh, wow, something's here. There's a there. Oh, how does that feel? Right? That's the joy. That's the joy, you know? And one thing Bhikkhu Bodhi said that I found really, really illuminating. Faith becomes an outlet for the pent-up tensions associated with suffering. Stress and tension fall away, the clouds part, the swell of joy arises, right? Joy to rapture, as joy deepens, rapture can arise, pitti, right? This can be very physical, right? This can be this feeling like we're shaking, or we feel our hair raise, you know, as we're in practice. You know, this happens especially when this joy is supported by meditation, right? When we start to actually become aware of what's going on, we kind of connect with this joy. It can deepen into this sort of rapture. And so to connect to this, I want to say a little bit about my own journey with this. For those of you who come on Sundays, I've said various versions of this many times. Around 2013, it had been years since I'd practiced meditation, and I'd practiced in a different lineage, a very valuable lineage, Advaita Vedanta, but it was a different way of practicing. And I'd kind of stopped. I was in the middle of my life, and I felt really clouded and confused. I felt like I couldn't really touch base with what was. I couldn't have told you if I was happy. I couldn't have told you if I was stressed. I just felt like I was existing in this cloud. And I probably wouldn't have even been able to say this, but there was a deep dissatisfiedness, a sense of dissatisfaction with that condition. And fortunately, I was very lucky to have touched on meditation earlier in my life and had it something that I was taught growing up even. And all I had was this sense that, like, there's something there. There's something in that that leads me out of this, that leads me into clarity. I don't really know how or why or how it's going to happen, but something was remembered that it could do that. And that's kind of the faith, right? Something was like, there's a better way. There's something leading me out of here. And so it caused me to pursue a retreat, and a retreat in this lineage, right? In this insight lineage. And so I went to this retreat, and I'm starting to hear instruction. And by the way, this wasn't like a retreat. This was at Esalen. Does anyone know this place? It's like, oh my God, it's like Candyland compared to retreats, right? You're on the cliffs facing the Pacific Ocean. There is good food. You can talk. Let's call it a workshop. It was a workshop. And so I'm receiving these teachings. I'm hearing this. It's clicking. It's starting to feel like there's a there. It's like, oh, this whole practice, this idea of just paying attention to what's here, letting things arise, letting things pass, not getting involved with the stories that my mind tells me. It all just felt like, yeah, this there's something here. This is real. And that led to joy. There was this feeling like, oh my God, I'm on to something. Something's happening here. There are all these other people. They're onto it too. There's this whole lineage. This has been going on for thousands of years, right? This isn't just some pipe dream. And we sat and we meditated. And there was a point in that week when rapture just took over. I was shaking. I couldn't speak for a lot of the week. It was this real feeling of rapture. It was very physical. And it's interesting because people have a lot to say about this rapture. I chased it for many years afterward. And when I would sit to meditate, I would try to bring up that same feeling of rapture, the shaking, all of that. And I think I wouldn't say it probably kept me from getting to tranquility, because I didn't want it to calm down. I didn't want that next thing. I was so into the rapture. But also there was a good side to it, which was I probably wouldn't be here, and I probably wouldn't have pursued this path if I hadn't had that. For me, it took that. For some other people, you're more dedicated. But I was a pretty fickle kind of guy. You know, I dabbled in one thing, I dabbled in another thing, and I would move on to the next and the next. That was just my nature at the time. So I probably would not have stuck with this if something pretty, you know, like that experience hadn't come to me. So there was a real benefit to that rapture. So in this sequence, right, the rapture leads to tranquility. That eventually happened, right? I actually got tired of the rapture, and I realized it was preventing me from meditating more deeply, right? Like I would evoke a shaking, quivering state because that's what I had experienced. And it would kind of, like my concentration would just go right away. I wasn't able to keep it. And eventually I got tired of that and I let myself settle, right? And this tranquility, what happens when we get tranquil? What happens when we let ourselves calm down from rapture? The agitation falls away. The restlessness falls away. The body becomes tranquil. The mind becomes tranquil, right? I'm gonna stop sharing the screen so we can see each other more. Let's do this again. Yeah. So then tranquility leads, the next step is happiness, right? Happiness sometimes translated as contentment. This contentment, it's a maturing of tranquility, right? We've gotten to a point where we've been able to settle, we've been able to get tranquil, we're releasing our agitation, we're building a base for stable awareness in a meditation practice. Contentment. This is a happiness, right? Different from rapture. While rapture contains happiness, they're not exactly the same thing, right? Rapture, Bhikkhu Bodhi describes it as more coarse. This kind of happiness, I like the word contentment. I prefer that translation. It's more subtle, right? This is without the intensity of rapture, right? And have you ever had a state of meditation? For those of us who've been practicing, if you've had a state of meditation where your mind just feels content to be placed on any object, you know, you're just kind of happy to be here. And if someone tells you, direct it to the breath, you can be like, okay, breath. Direct it to the tip of your nose, okay. Direct it even to your thoughts, your emotions, yeah. You know, that kind of contentment, right, is the contentment we're talking about. The mind is just happy. It's content to be placed anywhere. And in fact, happiness leads to concentration. The next thing is concentration. Because of this thing, because of this mind being contented, being a little bit like, kind of reminds me of like a ragdoll cat. You could just kind of pick it up and put it down anywhere, right? And I, you know, so happiness leading to concentration. This is something that took me a long time to realize, because I had been doing concentration wrong. For most of the time I'd been doing concentration, I had really been like putting a lot of like furrowed brow effort, concentrate. Okay, I'm going to concentrate on my breath, you know, push out other things, go to the breath. And really, that's not the way to have it be durable. That leads to a very fragile concentration. Cultivating a content mind, on the other hand, a happy mind that has that ragdoll kitten quality, right? Where you can just kind of place it on the breath, place it on any object you choose, that concentration is durable, right? So this points to that, right? Happiness leading to this concentration. Concentration leads to knowledge and vision of things as they are. Ain't that the truth, right? Here's where insight comes in, right? We call this insight meditation. We're Seattle Insight. This is the insight in Seattle Insight. This is what we're talking about. Knowledge and vision of things as they are, right? Vipassana is the term also for that kind of, well, actually that's not the term used here, but that is seeing things as they truly are. So when you're concentrated, you're not knocked off base as easily by the hindrances, right? The restlessness, the doubt, the craving, the aversion, the fatigue, the torpor, all of these things. And when you're not knocked off as easily, right, your mind is content, you're concentrated, you begin to see more clearly what your experience is really like, right? They talk about the five aggregates being known in this state, right? You start to feel in a direct way, not a conceptual way, what's happening. You feel material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, even consciousness itself, you can feel, you can notice that consciousness, that feeling, right? Those are the aggregates. And you see these things arise and you see these things pass, right? When we're seeing clearly and we're concentrated, they come and they go. We start to understand impermanence. And right here in the sequence, we're at a hinge between cultivation and release. I want to almost go back to the diagram. Let me share it one more time. here we are. Am I sharing? Oh, I'm sharing a window on another desktop. Good golly. Okay, I'm gonna say share. No? Okay.
You need to exit the full screen first.
Oh, is that what I need to do? Okay. Now I'm in it, huh? You got it again? Okay, cool. Yeah. So right where we are, this number 8 to number 9, We're at a hinge. This whole process, 1 through 8 so far, we've been cultivating, right? We've been creating conditions for seeing clearly. And everything beyond this is release. Once we see clearly, what happens? Once we have knowledge and vision of things as they are, we go from here to disenchantment. Disenchantment to dispassion, dispassion to freedom. To talk just briefly about each of those. Going from knowledge and vision to disenchantment. When we notice these things that pass away, we notice the instability, we notice the impermanence, right? And when we start to realize how impermanent all of these phenomena that arise are, we're just kind of done with it. Right? All the things that we've been chasing after in life, all the things we've been pushing away from, running towards, all those things, we just start to get a little tired of that. We start to look for something more stable, right? We might have had conceptual knowledge up to this point of the fact, right? We keep hearing over and over, if you've been in Dhamma talks for a while, you've heard over and over that, you know, all of this is impermanent, right? It arises and passes. It's not stable. This is the felt sense, right? You really feel it in your bones that this stuff just does not last. It does not make me happy. You get to disenchantment at that point. Disenchantment, it's described here. Oh, no. I was about to describe dispassion. Yeah, one thing I noticed, this is kind of just a personal analogy. When I think of disenchantment, so my block where I live is kind of divided into like people who are young. There's like a group of people who are younger, they're young couples and they're young families. And then there's a group of people who are older and they've been there generally for decades. And I'm somewhere in between these two. But I notice like, you can almost see like the young couples are like, they're building their lives at this point. They are into their careers, they are into their jobs, they are into the household renovations, they are doing things to their porches and their backyards, and they're creating stuff. And then in the other side, there's like, you know, the older people who are like, yeah, there are a few new buds on my hellebores this January. And, you know, I've been noticing the crows are a little mellower this year. You know, it's a totally different vibe you get from those folks on that side. And it kind of, I was thinking about that as I thought of this, like, it almost feels like, yeah, they're kind of done with the whole, like, building of life, creating things, accumulating things, you know, making the house a certain way. They're kind of done with that. You know, they're noticing the hellebores and the crows now, right? And I don't know, that somehow connects me to this disenchantment. I think that's what's being pointed at here. Disenchantment to dispassion. Dispassion is described as a deep yearning for deliverance from the round of samsaric becoming. This is when it becomes like, I am done. I was starting to become done in disenchantment. Now I yearn for the end of all that. All this cyclical suffering. I really want to get to the end. That's where I am when I'm at dispassion, right? And at this stage, right, when things start to provoke grasping and clinging, we're getting to a stage where those graspings and clingings are immediately abandoned, right? They come up and you're like, no, I'm done with that. I don't need to go there. Dispassion to freedom. Dispassion to freedom. The last taints that hold us back have been broken. The last fetters have been removed. This is it. This is freedom from ignorance. Greed, hatred, delusion, totally abandoned. Interesting to note, pleasure and pain still experienced, right? The Buddha felt, the Buddha had a painful back and sometimes couldn't sit, asked other people to sit. That's still real after enlightenment, right? Pleasure, pain, still experienced, but they don't lead to craving and aversion and all the rest, right? That's the difference. And then I found really interesting this last step. We're not done when we have freedom. From freedom, there is this retrospective reviewing of the path. Like, oh, I'm here. You know, I imagine it being something like you get to the top of a mountain and you look back at the trail and you see the whole path that led you there. And another thing that's important about this moment, I always wondered this, you know, when people are enlightened, do they know they're enlightened? You know, are they just sure about it? Apparently the answer is yes. So at this 12th stage, knowledge of the ending of the fetters or the taints, it's actually the taints, which is a very slightly different list from the fetters. When you're there, you recognize that not only have you walked this path, not only can you see the trail behind you, but you know that you are done. You know that you're done with this. It's not coming back. And from there, you can imagine, like, I think of the Buddha again when I think of this last step, because the Buddha decided with this, like, I gotta tell people, right? With this recognition, this knowledge of the ending, this looking at the path, he's like, I can explain this, right? In fact, if I recall, he thought it was a daunting task to explain initially, and then realized, like, okay, yeah, I can do this. I can explain it. That's coming from this knowledge. Right? So that's the path. And goodness, I've taken my time. It's that was 42 minutes. Thank you for sitting with me. So we will, I believe now there is time for questions. We don't take another break, do we? We go right into the questions. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I am a student here, y'all. So, you know, I encourage your thoughts. Your questions, that doesn't sound right to me. All of that. I wanna encourage a discussion here, because I'm curious too. And I know that for people online, you can raise your hand. And for people here, there's a microphone that gets passed around, right? So do people raise their hands? Is that the instruction here? Yeah. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
So where would you say a lot of people are along this transcendental thing? I was in another path too a few years ago. I was 10 years and I'm following along with this and I'm thinking, okay, maybe at times I was in five or six, but certainly never at the end.
Yeah.
What's your experience with that? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Great question. I for sure was asking myself the same question the whole time I was looking at this. So there are a couple of things I would say. One is that this path is not, even though it is a progression, it's a sequence, it's not a one and done thing until you get to the very end, right? When you actually are done. A lot of the steps coming down that path are described as something we experience and re-experience over and over and over again. So possibly for those of us who've been practicing for a little bit, you may see a lot of this sequence in your own experiences, right? In the same way I've described this. Like I described an experience I went through over a few years, right? Where I kind of moved in, you know, I had this faith, I moved from there to a joy, I moved from there to a rapture. But within that, right, like in this fractal kind of way, like Tori was talking about fractals last week, there were all these mini episodes of completely losing the faith. Start going right back into the suffering, recultivating the faith, recultivating from the faith to the joy. Joy goes away. Sometimes the joy doesn't come. I have the faith and the joy isn't there. Where is it? The conditions aren't right. It's not coming. The joy coming to the rapture, sometimes that happens. Sometimes the rapture leads to the next steps, right? Like you could keep going down these sometimes, but what you probably see happening in your, you know, what I see in my happening, so maybe I just suspect other people see this too, is you'll see yourself go from one to the next, jump back up, go down. Sometimes you'll jump back, you'll go a little further. Sometimes you'll jump back, you'll go a little further, right? And it goes on over and over again. As far as where people are on this, I couldn't speculate. And again, from what I'm saying, it's probably all of us can relate to some of these some of the time, that we're in those places some of the time. Yeah, that's my best guess at the answer. Yeah. Yeah, Suze. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything online. I don't see anyone online.
Well, and kind of following up on the question that was just asked, I think sometimes I find myself going back to the mundane dependent origination, because there's certain conditions that created beliefs and views and habit patterns that are so strong that even though I've like conceptually understood them, the connection between the belief, view, habit, and behavior seems like there's almost like not a breath in between. Mm. And so even though there are aspects of my life where I feel I'm in the transcendental one, then, you know, I like my last retreat. There I was back in the old one.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, what the hell? I thought I had been working on this one. And there it was. And so I just think that that's part of the being on the path.
Yeah.
And there's, it was helpful for me. That retreat was so difficult in that it was kind of discouraging and super humbling. But then when I came back home and then I kind of looked at my practice, and I also saw all the times where I wasn't back there. Mm. I was on this other path of seeing things more clearly. So, I think there.
Oh yeah.
I think that's, at least in my life, in my path, I'm certainly there.
Can anyone else relate to that, what Suze just said? Okay, a bunch of hands going up. Yeah.
There's somebody online.
Online as well. That's very relatable. Yeah, we're always going through that, right? Maybe we repeat that mundane until the end. I don't know. What do you think? Yeah. Yeah.
All of a sudden, boom. Oh, and I think even the Buddha kept on saying, I see you, Mara.
Right.
You're coming back. You're at it again.
Yeah.
And it's like, mind, you're at it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes the way I think of this, this is just my own personal analogy. I imagine that this path is a little bit like, less like a linear path and more like I'm in the wilderness somewhere. And every now and then I beat a path. I find that I've gotten somewhere. And by getting somewhere, I am slowly beating a neural trail to that path, to that place again. But I find myself right back at the beginning plenty of times. But it's not without some movement, right? After a while, we do find ourselves right back at the beginning, but we look around us and there are a bunch of trails. You know? Trails from one place to the next to the next. I feel like I'm slowly beating down these trails and just kind of, but yeah, I'm also going in circles, right? Trying to find my way out of the wilderness. Yeah. Yeah. I see Tara Leigh Bell. Did I say that correctly?
Tara Leigh. Tara Leigh.
Tara Leigh.
Yeah.
Tara Leigh.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned neural pathways, because I know there's a question in here somewhere, or maybe like 10 questions, but one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot as I've been exploring Buddhism is, in the West, which is how I've mostly encountered it, it's been what I would describe as like heavily secularized and heavily psychologized. And on the one hand, I love it because I use it a lot in therapy. Like it's like foundational for me. But I was really struck by the word faith. And I don't know why. We've talked about this a couple weeks now, but today I was like, oh yeah, faith. That sounds like religion. And That was my thought. And it just sort of has me reflecting on I tend to be very I'm very religion enthusiastic. I love gods and goddesses and prostrations, and I love all the incense and all the things. So figuring out where I fit in American Buddhism has been interesting because it feels like
Yeah.
a lot of white walls. But I'm just curious about, because I am also struck by, as I look at this list, it feels like a spiritual or a religious path, but it also, there isn't, one of the things that it made me think of, and you mentioned that you're from the Advaita Vedanta tradition originally. In that tradition, because I was in that tradition for a little while too, I was really encouraged to have like an Ishta Devata, that like a god that I would focus my meditation on, focus like a mantra on, focus energy on. And this list of things, there's not somebody to lean on. Like, it's very much like, here you go, this is your work, this is your work to do. And I'm just curious if you can speak to that. Like, this feels not in a, I don't mean it like in a bad way, but it feels very, very much like the Buddha has sort of handed you, it's like he's handed you a get out of jail free card, but you have to do all the legwork, and there isn't somebody, you're not even leaning on the Buddha. Like, you don't even get anybody to lean on. And I was just curious if you could speak to that at all, like the sort of
Wow.
like aloneness of it. I don't know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Tara Lee, that's a big and important topic. There's so much in what you said I relate to in so many ways. Yes, right? There isn't really mention of God, in any of this. And so especially if we're coming from religions where the thing that we rest on, the thing we take refuge in is God or a God telling you and something dictated from that God or, gods about what to do. This can feel really different. The Buddha is a human, right? A human with a backache, right? Who said, "Hey, I figured something out. Let me show you how to do it." And he also said, "You have to see for yourself," right? Ehi Pasuko. You see, you test whether this works for yourself, right? That's different. So what do we do? Well, there are refuges, but they aren't, they, all I can say personally is they don't feel like the refuges of the religions that rely on God. We're asked to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, right? And the Buddha, we're not talking necessarily about the literal, we could be. I mean, if that is what gives you inspiration and feels like a support, you could be talking about the historical figure, the human. But we're taking refuge in the possibility of enlightenment, is another interpretation of that, of taking refuge in the Buddha. Just the fact that, like, oh, this is something that could happen, right? So this is a little like that faith step, right? Although it's a little bigger than that in a way. Faith, we're just thinking like, there's got to be a way out of this, right? And this is saying, this isn't dissimilar, but this is taking refuge in the possibility of a permanent enlightenment, right? This is a thing we can do. This is a thing a human being did, a human being who said, if I didn't think you could do this, I would not ask you to do this. I'm just an ordinary human being who did this, and so are you, and so can you. Right? So he's asking us to take refuge in that possibility for each of us because he's just another person who did this. The Dhamma, right? The path. This is the thing he gave us that he didn't quite start off with in the same way himself, right? He's saying there's a path. Take refuge in that. Here's some ways of creating the conditions by which this sequence we're talking about today can happen. And the Sangha, right? We're all in it together. We take refuge in each other. We move together. We celebrate our victories. We weep over our over our sorrows. Mm-hmm. The things that we fail to do over and over again, we fail over and over together.
Mm-hmm.
We keep going back to the suffering. We keep backsliding, whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
All those feelings, we do it together. So those are the refuges as I understand them in this practice. And yeah, they are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious to hear other takes on that too, if anyone has something they want to say.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great question.
Hi, Evan. It's my question is maybe a bit related, so no, maybe not. So I'm sorry if I'm switching gears.
That's fine.
So I was reading a book about I'm not even sure exactly what tradition it is, but they were making a point that if you want to reach like enlightenment, so I guess the last steps,
yeah,
having a master and someone who is already enlightened or close to be enlightened, like, is almost a requirement to really get there as well.
Mm.
Like getting there by yourself alone, just by meditation and sangha and so on, is like so hard that it's considered like not possible. I think it was like Tibetan, maybe Buddhism. So I guess there are different schools, different traditions.
Yeah.
And I'd like to, if you know a bit about this, I mean, is it kind of a general agreement among like Buddhism and practitioners, or maybe it's specific to that school, and maybe for Vipassana it's not the case, and anyone by themselves could get to freedom and
knowledge. So I think there are different takes here. This is an area again where I'm a student, but I'll tell you a little bit about my understanding. And this is an understanding based on the limited amount I've read, and I think other people in the room could probably fill in too. First, I would say a really excellent series that helps answer this question is there is a multi-class series that Christina Feldman taught at Seattle Insight many years ago, and it's still available online. I think it's like it's broken into between 7 and 9 parts, where she talked about the end of suffering, all the ways of getting there, all the ways that different people envision how to get there, the different descriptions from people who have reached there. And it varies so much, you know? So I think the short answer to your question is that there are many different takes on this. And I would also say that the many different takes are not, there's not one that's right, because the descriptions of people who have actually reached that last stage vary so much. There are descriptions of people who achieved enlightenment, like they just went through all these steps in a flash of lightning. You know, they started in suffering and then they heard a lecture by the Buddha or something happened, and in a flash of understanding, boom, enlightened. That's one thing that apparently happens. And you can create the, and in people who look at that path and think about that path, talk about the fact that you can create the conditions for that lightning flash, but you can't actually make it happen. So you just create conditions. But then there are many descriptions of people who go in a much, who walk a much slower path, who go for, you know, lifetimes, you know, many, many lifetimes of making slow progress, moving from one stage of understanding to another, to another. And for those people reaching, you know, so for people, you know, who are already, you know, maybe you're once returned, you're one of these later stages, it might take a little bit less, you know, to push you over the edge. Maybe a master helps with that. Maybe something else helps with that. Maybe you have an experience that's just a flash of understanding. Or you sit and something, just a felt sense of something that you only understood, I'm just guessing, I don't know. You know, something happens, you know, as you're practicing. And then also there are other people who maybe are many, many lifetimes away from that end. And perhaps sitting with a master wouldn't get you all the way there. Maybe it would cause you to have incremental, maybe dramatic progress. So the one way of answering your question is, I don't know. It certainly sounds like a wonderful thing to have available a master who is either at that stage or near that stage. But I mean, the Buddha did not have such a master. And there have been many people throughout time. The Buddha was not the first person to become enlightened either, right? And there have been many people who did not have precedent, who did not have the Dhamma existing in the world for other people to show them the path and for there to be this community even. And they reached that stage. They discovered this. And they were ordinary human beings. So it certainly seems possible from that description without this necessary condition of a human master like that. But that's just from my limited understanding. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy to hear other people's takes on that too. Again, wow, what a great question. What a grand question. Yeah. Yeah, Sherry.
I just feel like I could share that it's this lineage and the focus on individual practice. There seems to be like a real holding of this question of what are things as they are. What are things as they are that I find I actually find it deeply spiritual, and in a way that allows me space to be in the practice. That, like others have mentioned, I came here from a different lineage where I really couldn't quite settle in. Because there was just too many trappings of religiosity in the practice, and so I was not so. I just couldn't settle in. I was there, but I kept rubbing against something and kept wandering off because yeah. And so it's been quite a beautiful opening for me to join this Sangha and its white walls that I feel are very filled out with all of the humans and their long, deep practices and their willingness to share and the diversity of teachers speaking from all of your different points of view and the assistant teachers and the Dharma leaders. And it's just a very rich, rich community. And so about that, about this community, but also like golly, whichever path works for us, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I hear what you're saying. I know people who are, you know, who are all over the map with this, right? Like I know people who really love the ritual associated with religion, you know, with conventional religious ritual, who love the ways that those support you. And there are people who love the white walls. I'm a white wall person myself. I like the cleanliness of the inquiry. It's just see for yourself and just notice what's here. And that feels trustworthy to me. But for other people, there are different things that work, and I completely agree. That, you know, there are probably a lot of things that work. There are probably a lot of ways. And we can customize that to what fits our path. Yeah. Thanks for that observation. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of had a question about this concept of like identifying with
Did it go away?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
You're on.
Conceptually understanding something versus like identifying with it.
Yeah.
Like there are certain things that I can kind of logically reason, like the impermanence of my existence, stuff like that, but I have a hard time like identifying with that too much. I think in some ways, like my ego is kind of afraid to, because I don't know what I'd do with that.
Yeah. That totally makes sense. Yeah. This felt sense, the difference between the conceptual understanding and having a real felt direct sense of it is a big thing. I'm going to start with smaller examples than, you know, the whole idea of impermanence, the really grand ones, right? I realize that a lot of the time when I am meditating and I'm trying to notice my breath, I am not noticing my breath. I have conceptualized what my breath is going to do. I know that there's going to be an inhale following the exhale, and that there's going to be an exhale following the inhale. And my mind just kind of does this thing where it's like, okay, we can just turn on the autoplay loop. We don't actually have to be here for this breath, this inhale and this exhale. And I wonder if you can relate to that. There's a feeling, sometimes you're really there, you're feeling this breath. And sometimes you're just taught, you're thinking about the concept of the breath. Same thing can happen with the body. You can be asked to go to your body, and you can just be in the conceptual sense of your body. The body your mind imagines, it's a bit like this. Your mind can do a pretty good job of figuring out what the body's supposed to feel like, and it'll just project that, instead of you being in the actual body. And every now and then, you might relate to the fact that you feel completely there. You know, you're actually in your body. You're actually in this seat. You're actually listening to that sound. You're actually breathing this breath. And that's the felt sense of it. And as the path matures and as it grows, some of these more and more abstract things can kind of hit like in that same felt sense kind of way that you can suddenly realize the actual breath versus the conceptual breath. You can actually, impermanence suddenly can like, whoa, you know, you really, it can rattle you in a way that the conceptual understanding does not. And it's just a matter of sticking with practice and letting what comes up come up and letting things pass. And, you know, just all of a sudden the arising and passing clicks in this strange way. And it's like, oh my God, that thing that arose, it's really just gonna go. You know, and you feel it in your bones instead of just thinking that that's true. Yeah. I don't know if that helps. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of the things that I think this notion of faith is so interesting about this notion of faith in Buddhism. I remember a few years ago, the first time I was introduced in a Dharma talk to the concept of faith, it really threw me off as well. I had a very reactive, I was very reactive to it, right? Because I'd have had a lot of history with religion in my past that wasn't always positive. And so I was like, whoa. So, because I thought of faith as something that I had to accept without evidence.
Right.
But in Buddhism, the way I think about faith is it's actually kind of the opposite. The Buddha is saying, here is all of this evidence of what can happen. I'm going to give you the exact sequence of things that's going to happen. Here's how it's going to work. And there's all these people who are going to tell you, and you're going to see it in your own life. This is the way it's going to work out. But now it's up to you to decide if you want to do that. And the faith in Buddhism is, as I understand it, is just having the belief that if I stick with this, the path will keep unfolding. It will keep moving in that way. But it's so hard sometimes to keep following the evidence. We all fall away so often, right? So just having the trust in sticking with it, I think is so interesting.
Totally. Yeah, that's a great way of describing it. Thank you, Ryan. Yeah. And it happens to all of us, right? You know, one of the main hindrances is doubt. You know, it could be doubt in the path or just doubt in our ability. Okay, that might apply to some people. It doesn't apply to me. And I go through that all the time. And it's crazy. I'll go through a phase of having absolute strength at like, yeah, this is working, this works. And then the next moment, I'll even call into question that it ever worked. You know, was I ever actually meditating? Did any of these things actually happen? You know, I can go that deep down the doubt path. And I'm sure others can relate. I'm seeing nodding heads. Yeah, we can do that, can't we? And this isn't sort of an unwavering faith or an ask to believe in something that we have never touched, right? It's almost a recognition of what we already have faith in. In this context, in this transcendental dependent arising, I think of it a little bit that way. Like, there are some things we have faith in that we don't even think of as faith. Like, if I stand up, I have faith that I won't fall through the floor. The earth will bear me. If I take a step forward again, I have faith that it's going to happen, right? Like, I'm going to be able to reach firm ground and I'm going to move in that direction, that I can do that. We don't think about that kind of faith. And in the same way, like, that's why I was asking, like, what brought you here already? Because I'm with you. I'm allergic to the word faith. And it reminds me of all these things about religion that I just, yeah, it's stuff I don't like the word, and it gives me this feeling. At the same time, none of us would be here at this moment without some kind of faith. There is something that is already true in us that makes, you could even say to yourself, I'm just here checking this out, right? Like, I don't know if there's anything behind this. I just want to, and that's fine. That is actually what the path asks you to do, is find out for yourself. But if you didn't think there could be some there, you wouldn't be here.
I think that's what's so powerful about it. And what I find so powerful about it being the first step in this transcendental dependent arising, that every time we choose in the morning, I'm pretty tired, am I really gonna sit down and meditate this morning, or should I sleep for an extra 15 minutes?
Right.
And plenty of times I choose the latter.
Yep.
But when I make that choice to do the former, to sit, every time that's a little act of faith that's moving me up that chain. It's that little thing that says, yes, I'm gonna trust in this process, even though my body says it wants to sleep. And if I trust in that process, it's going to unfold and help me move forward.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's faith is the first step, I think, is a real sort of game-changing way to think about Buddhism for me.
Yeah, that is a great point. And you're also pointing to another thing, which is that these steps don't just happen. We don't just move from one to the next. We create the conditions, and we you know, with our intentions, we allow the moving from one to the next. We have to choose the sitting versus the sleeping, every now and then at least, right? in order to see that happen. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
On the faith question, so I have this faith as well.
Yeah.
It's a bit harmless at the same time, like, I mean, it doesn't cost much to believe it's possible.
Mm.
And I always wonder, there might be another, I mean, the next level of faith is actually seeing it for yourself, in a sense, like, right. You hear, for example, people who say they have met the Dalai Lama, or who have met people enlightened, and they will say, like, something is a bit different. Like, you have, like, witnesses say, like, they don't speak exactly to you like anyone else, or they don't look at you, and there is this like sense of like something is a bit different. So we'll say like your faith could also be strengthened or like change if you, when you, maybe you have, or maybe someone in the room has, like you meet someone and you think, okay, now I've seen it by my eyes. I have like, I've talked with someone and I know it actually does exist. It's not just like there is this guy like
right.
2,500 years ago who said, did it and like said all those things. It's just one step above.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about that maybe? Or?
Sure, sure. I'll talk. I know I want to be mindful of time too, because we want to leave a little room for announcements at the end. But yeah, you're talking about the faith that arises when you see a living example
of a person who has sort of gone to a stage that you immediately recognize as, oh, this is a person who's way down that list somewhere. Yeah. That can be a very, very powerful thing. I was thinking about that today, in fact, as I was contemplating the sort of later stages. I was thinking of people I've met who inspire that, you know, and I didn't think of them explicitly as, oh, this is a person at number 11 or at number 10. You know, I just knew this is a person who's got something and I want what they've got. and that can be hugely inspiring. But I also want to bring back to the faith we're talking about in this context, right? This, it really is, my understanding of it from this sutta and the way it's laid out is when we go through the mundane dependent arising, the left-hand column, over and over again, it creates this kind of, there's got to be something more, right? We've seen this, it's evidence-based. We've seen ourselves go through this over and over in our lives. And to jump off onto the right column, onto the transcendent, onto that transcendental dependent arising path, we're jumping off in a way because we have cultivated the faith. That's why it's the first thing there, that there's got to be something better. There's got to be something out there other than this going through the, you know, the same motions over and over, beating ourselves up, suffering, doing the habits of the mind that we always do. And my sense is it's pointing to that kind of faith. And the same faith, you know, you can think of the Buddha again going out and saying like, man, you know, there's suffering everywhere. Everyone is of the nature to die. And we suffer all this time and, you know, there's got to be something. And he goes out in search of it, right? It's that kind of, so when we're at the top of that chain, right, the near, we're only at number two on the list at this point. We don't need necessarily the faith that comes from seeing like a living example. What you're talking about is a very powerful thing that moves you forward, can really propel you down the path. But we really only need something that's a bit smaller than that to gain the energy to start pursuing a different path, to stop repeating this over and over again. Yeah. All right. I think we should probably move to announcements now since we've only got a couple of minutes left. So a couple, I know, you're on. Okay, why don't you start? Why don't you start, okay. Please? Yeah. Yeah.
I remember now.
Yeah.
All right, it is next Monday is the last Monday of the month. And that means we can have dinner together. Bring your dinner, bring your drink. Be here around 6 o'clock or whenever you want to show up before the sit. We go till about 10 of 7 so we can clean up the room. Every time we've had this, it has been a wonderful experience. I've met people who I wouldn't have talked to. I've learned a lot of things. I mean, you can talk about mundane things. Or I hear a lot of people going, so where'd you get into this and what do you think and how do you feel? And you know, you don't have those conversations in daily life. So I encourage everyone to come and what would, in a religious sense, it would be break bread.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Just a couple of other quick announcements. On the 21st, which there is a class beginning on the east side. So the east side Sangha is beginning an intro class in meditation. So it lasts 6 weeks, I think, starting the 21st of January. On the 22nd of January, an intro class starts based here. And that again is a 6 week class. Beginning that date. So that's all coming up soon. It's on the Sims calendar. You can go online and see all the details for yourself there. The last thing is that the 31st of this month and the 1st, Rodney Smith is giving a retreat, a weekend retreat then. And my understanding is this may be his last non-residential weekend retreat at Sims. So this is Sims's founder, giving his last non-residential retreat on the tie between the Heart Sutta and the Noble and the Four Noble Truths.
No, and the Four Foundations.
And the Four Foundations. Okay, the Four Foundations and the Heart Sutta.
But it doesn't matter what Rodney is teaching because he's really great.
Sue's just said, whatever Rodney teaches, he's really great at. So just come to it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's all I had. I think we're clear. Thank you. Does anyone need a ride home? No one here? Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks, everyone online. Thanks, everyone in the room. Thanks for being here. Yeah. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Arv.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you
very much.